Our first case for argument this morning is Irigen Biosciences against Nucleic Acids Licensing. Ms. Kernut.
May it please the Court, my name is Heather Kernut, and I represent the appellant, Nucleic Acids Licensing, LLC, and cross-appellee, Dr. Stephen A. Benner. This is a simple breach of contract case that has been made complicated by Irigen's concealment.
There are quite a few things that have made this case complicated, Ms. Kernut. One of them is that I can't find a final judgment in this case. The district court entered a document that appears to be a final judgment, at least on Rule 58 paper, but all it says is that motions, that each side's motion for summary judgment is granted in part and denied in part. Is there any final judgment?
I believe that there was a final judgment entered on the form judgment sheet, and I had believed that it was attached to the last page of the appendix in the brief, but
well,
I may be mistaken.
If that's all the district court has done, then there's no final judgment in this case, and we lack jurisdiction. This is a case involving a demand for money, and no judgment is final until the amount of money that the prevailing party gets from the losing party is put down by the court in a judgment. It also has to specify interest. And there appears to be no quantification of the relief that's been awarded in this case.
There was no relief awarded in this case. The underpayment that the district court found had been paid in February of 2006 by Irigen. So that the district court's judgment was that the motion for
a debt. The district court needs to say that. You know, The Supreme Court's been pretty clear. It actually said just last week that a judgment declaring liability, that a document declaring liability but omitting relief is not final and is not appealable. Reiterated that point in Riley against Kennedy a week ago today. Well, actually 6 days ago, because last week ago today was a holiday. So unless parties go to the district court and get a final judgment, probably nothing at all is going to happen on this appeal. I suggest that you and Mr. Schreiner might want to go and see if you can get the district court to enter a final judgment. But I don't know why any lawyer looking at a document issued by a district court saying motions have been granted, but not specifying the relief to which the prevailing party is entitled, would think there was a final judgment.
I apologize because I do not have what I thought was a judgment in front of me to be able to respond to exactly what.
Well, you should proceed.
And I apologize for not having that document in front of me right now. Irigen's concealment began on day one when it failed to disclose even the existence of the cystic fibrosis agreement it had signed with Bayer, an agreement that relies on the Aegis technology. The concealment continued on September 1st when Irigen failed to provide the royalty.
What agreement are you talking about?
I'm talking about the Aegis agreement that was entered into between Nucleic Acid, between Dr. Benner and was assigned to Nucleic Acids Licensing LLC and Irigen Biosciences.
But then I thought you were, if I'm not mistaken, in your reply brief, I guess, you said that there are two sublicenses with Bayer, one of them being the sublicense people are talking about most of the time, and the other being this cystic fibrosis license that you allege used the technologies specified in the Aegis agreement. But that seems to be this sort of fleeting piece of paper, and I'm not sure when that was brought to the district court's attention or whether that license made it into the record. Maybe you could specify.
The cystic fibrosis agreement was first.
Am I correct right away that this is a sublicense that Irigen allegedly entered into with Bayer?
We contend that it's a sublicense. Irigen contends that it is not a sublicense and that it is it relates to one of its patents and that it does not relate to the Aegis technology.
Okay.
Press releases released by Irigen indicate that it relates to the Aegis technology, and the language of the agreement, and specifically Section 5.12, addresses what they call in that agreement the Benner Agreement and how it will change the amount of royalties that are paid to Dr. Benner under the earlier 2000 sublicense agreement, which is the one that was related to the revenues about which we had the accruing dispute.
So is the cystic fibrosis license itself between Aerogen and Bayer in the record?
It is in the record. It is attached as Exhibit B to the third declaration of Irene Krusofsky that was submitted to the court and for the first time to my client. Well, it was not submitted to my clients. It was submitted attorney's eyes only to Nucleic Acids Licensing, LLC, after summary judgment briefing was completed. The procedural posture, Aerogen filed for summary judgment on November 22nd, 6 weeks before the summary judgment deadline, when Nucleic Acid Licensing responded, and because the motions for a declaratory judgment, one side was moving for a declaration that the agreement had terminated and the other side was moving that it wasn't, it made sense to cross-move for summary judgment when we filed the response brief for summary judgment. In documents first produced within a week before the Nucleic Acid Licensing's response to Aerogen's motion for summary judgment, Aerogen for the first time identified that it had received a $525,000 payment from Bayer in the first half of 2005 for a cystic fibrosis license. They did not produce the agreement, even though it had all communications between Aerogen and Bayer had been requested in discovery requests and all documents relating to the Aegis agreement and the Aegis technology. Because of the press of completing the response to summary judgment, we were not able to analyze the import of that line item showing a payment for the cystic fibrosis license until after filing that brief. On the deadline set by the court for motions for summary judgment, we filed an amended proposed finding of fact that took into account that we were contending that royalties should have been paid on that $525,000.
These are the two amendments that the district court permits you to file.
Correct. And the district court permitted Aerogen to respond to those amendments. Aerogen did respond to those amendments and supported its response to those amendments with the third declaration of Irene Krusofsky, which is where it attached cystic fibrosis license. So our position is that it is properly before the court on summary judgment because the district court allowed Aerogen to respond to the amended proposed findings of fact, which were on the summary judgment motion, and that license came in on their response to that motion. It is also our position that our motion to strike the declaration, which pointed the court to certain provisions of the agreement that we believed were inconsistent with Dr. Husovsky's declaration, was also properly before the court on summary judgment because the summary judgment had been completed and because Aerogen had failed to produce the cystic fibrosis license agreement when it should have during discovery.
So if this had been produced, you wouldn't be having this discussion about what accruing means.
Correct. That if the 134,000.
You'd be arguing something else. Maybe they would be disagreeing with you, of course, because if there's an underlying issue about the technology involved in the cystic fibrosis license, that's a different matter. But you wouldn't be, if you were to prevail in your view of the cystic fibrosis license, doesn't matter what accruing means.
That is correct.
But let me see if I can. The revenues accruing language in Section 3.7 really seems to emphasize accrual of income rather than receipt, right?
I would respectfully disagree.
Okay. Well, why exactly is that language ambiguous, as Judge Crabb believed it was? Why is that ambiguous?
The language is ambiguous because the entire Aegis agreement, which is what must be looked at to determine the meaning of each individual phrase, is based on receipt of revenue. The net sales is defined as gross amounts received. Accruing cannot have Aerogen's preferred meaning as it relates to net sales. And sublicenses is essentially defined in Section 3.4, which also talks about gross amounts received that must be paid to nucleic acids licensing. The word accruing must have the same meaning as it's used with respect to net sales, as it must have the same meaning in that sense as it when it's used to refer to sublicensing or grants.
Why is that so? Because it seems to me the part of the agreement that has been the subject of this debate about accruing is really just trying to decide when does the 10% royalty obligation give way to the 25% royalty obligation. The parties could have done that by the phase of the moon. The parties could have done that anyway they wanted. So just because some things are determined by receipt of revenue doesn't mean that they had to choose that line.
That's correct, but the accruing is a common English word that in the context of this agreement has its usual non-technical meaning of arising from. If accruing was meant to refer in the technical sense to the accrual method of accounting, it should have been defined as a defined term in the Aegis agreement.
Why? The agreement refers in one place to receipt of money and it refers in another to accrual. Doesn't that tell us that these are different terms?
In the context of Section 3.7, the net sales itself indicates that it's a receipt of amounts received for products, and so accruing, it would be redundant to use the word receipt in that to say it's received from amounts received.
Well, I mean, you can say that, but I guess it's a more common canon of construction to assume that when the parties have chosen a different word, they meant you to think of something different. They meant that there was a different meaning attached. Accruing is hardly an unusual word in the world of business.
I would agree that it's not an unusual word, but it is a word that has different meanings. So at a minimum, it's the meaning of accruing as used, the undefined word meaning of accruing as used in this agreement is then ambiguous. There's no mention in the Aegis agreement anywhere that Aerogen uses the accrual method of accounting.
But why does their method, I mean, I realize people can change methods of accounting when they wish to do so, and maybe Aerogen still uses the accrual method. Maybe it's moved to the cash method, for all I know. But if the parties have chosen accrued obligations as the point at which this royalty obligation will change over, that's just a moment in time. This is a one-time-only debate, right?
It is a one-time-only debate. That's correct. Mm-hmm. And the step-up rate was highly negotiated. It was a main incentive for entering into this agreement under which Aerogen was released of many of the obligations it had had under the previous agreements. Section 3.4C has some very non-standard language indicating that that Dr. Benner was extremely concerned that they were going to try to deprive him of revenue, particularly from Bayer, and that they tried to think of all these possibilities under which that the amount of revenue that would be paid would be decreased. It's simply inconsistent with the intent of the parties as evidenced by the entire Aegis agreement that Dr. Benner could have intended to reduce the amount.
When you say intent of the parties, are you referring to any concrete documents exchanged between the parties during the negotiation?
I was trying to stay away from that, but there are concrete documents.
I don't know what else intent means in a contract case. All the states, including Florida, so far as I can see, follow the objective theory of contract interpretation, so that the only thing that matters to interpretation are the signs and symbols exchanged between the parties and not the contents of somebody's head never communicated to the other side. So the question is, what was communicated here that would show one usage of the word accrual versus another?
What Aerogen had offered in the negotiations was to step up the rate from 10% to 25% for all transactions on or after February 15th, 2005.
Doesn't the transaction language suggest accrual also?
A transaction
does to me.
Makes things worse for you.
I respectfully disagree. A transaction is a completed event that changes relations between the parties.
All right. What I understood Judge Wood to be saying, my question too, when you said what you said, is that suggests the 25% rate is due only on royalty agreements that were entered into after February 15th, 2005. But surely that's not your position, because then you get even less.
That is not my position, and Arigen has not argued that, and I believe it's undisputed that was not the intent of the parties.
Transactions, the lesser meaning would simply be sales events by sub-licensees, such as Bayer, that generate a right to revenue, even if that revenue hasn't been paid over yet. In other words, accrued revenue. And so then the parties substitute the accrual language, and there we are.
May I take you, please, to the October 31st letter? Because Arigen said that it was assuming the termination notice was null and void, and it invited NAL to speak up if it disagreed. Why didn't NAL waive termination by failing to respond to that letter and to disabuse Arigen of its assumption that the breach had been cured and that the contract would not be terminated?
NAL had told Arigen that it considered the notice of termination in effect, that it considered that Arigen had breached the agreement on multiple occasions leading up to then, on September 2nd. On October 24th, a week before the October 31st letter, NAL sent a second notice of termination since it had been able to narrow down the breach of the agreement to the Aegis agreement as opposed to the other two agreements, and listed all of the breaches known to it at that point. NAL was not required to engage in a futile back and forth with Arigen when Arigen just failed to provide any evidence that the amounts had been received before February 15th, but just continued to insist that NAL had to hire attorneys to negotiate with it.
But doesn't it seem somewhat odd that for almost 4 months neither NAL or Dr. Benner made any response to this letter?
Dr. Benner was trying to determine the information to know that the agreement had terminated, because Arigen had concealed the information that would let it know that. It had responded to all of Arigen's previous requests, and there simply did not seem any point in engaging in a further back and forth with Arigen.
And then, well, as I understand it, NAL accepted the February 28th payment, notwithstanding the fact that at least some portion of that payment accrued after the date that NAL says that the contract terminated. And wouldn't that suggest that the parties were still treating the contract as valid and ongoing?
Because of Arigen's concealment of the material facts regarding when it received the buyer payments, its underpayment from other sub-licenses, the existence of the cystic fibrosis agreement, NAL had no way of knowing, confirming it thought that the agreement had terminated, but it didn't have evidence regarding that with respect to the buyer royalty reports until April 6th. Contemporaneously with depositing the February 28th payment, Dr. Brenner and NAL sent a very clear notice of termination, because with the February 28th check, Arigen finally admitted that it had underpaid royalties by approximately $7,000. If I may reserve my remaining time.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Schreiner.
Morning, Your Honors.
Morning.
May it please the Court, I will start with the jurisdictional point. I take your point, Judge Easterbrook.
It's not only money, it's There were cross requests for declaratory relief, and line one says the motion for declaratory relief is granted, but where's the declaratory relief?
Well, it is also, line one says it's request for a declaration that the Aegis Agreement is valid. That was the declaration. That it was a request for declaratory relief. That's all we asked for, is a declaration that was valid. All they asked for in declaratory relief was a declaration that it had terminated. So, I mean, it could have been better done. There's no question about that. And I should have caught it. There's no question about that. But there are cases from this court saying, too, that when it's clear what the district judge thought and what was intended,
you don't want to trust us on that after Riley against Kennedy.
The
justices could not have been clearer in Riley that until all the relief for which the parties have requested is provided in a judgment,
right,
there is nothing that's appealable.
But, of course, in Riley versus Kennedy, there was just a liability determination, and it was clear that the question of injunctive relief or not hadn't been taken up. Here, I think Judge Crabb has clearly indicated in her opinion that she's done with the case.
Well, I don't want to beat this into the ground because I think what the parties need to do is fix this.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
the panel normally in such cases continues to stay with the case.
Right.
So you're not utterly wasting your time. But the fact is, how when you grant summary judgment in favor of Aerojin with respect to these various claims,
right,
you need to know what money is there.
Well, what the money is not a problem either, in the sense that, again, Judge Crabb said the money hadn't received claims or unjust enrichment claims. We claimed that we'd overpaid. They claimed that they'd underpaid.
No, I know the point.
And she said nobody gets any money.
Right.
You may have you didn't overpay, she said, with respect to our claim, and she said with respect to Aerojin's, you've waived termination. So,
I'm disturbed, moving on, by her failure in her lengthy opinion to say anything about this cystic fibrosis license, because Ms. Kernet's rehearsal of how that came in certainly coincides with my own recollection of how these two findings of fact came in. And it strikes me that one way of looking at this is Aerojin was only very slowly disclosing things that might or might not have been governed by the Aegis Agreement. I don't know if that is or not, frankly. It seems to me it's a disputed issue of fact, and there might need to be further proceedings about it.
If I may, Your Honor, address that. There wasn't any slowness to disclose. The Cystic Fibrosis Agreement, which is Exhibit B at Record 81, is not a sublicensing agreement. Bayer didn't need another sublicensing agreement to practice the Benner patents. It already had the Aegis Agreement, which is a sublicensing agreement to practice the Benner patents.
Well, I think that had the district judge spoken to any of this, I understand that's probably what you would be arguing. It clearly
This is a grant of rights under Benner patents. This isn't a grant of rights under
that, I would have to sit down and look at the list of patents covered by the Aegis Agreement, figure out what the claims cover, figure out what this license did. There's a lot of
analysis. I just misspoke. The Cystic Fibrosis Agreement is a grant of rights under Aerojin patents.
So you say, and I gather there is a dispute.
What it says. It's Exhibit D it says what the intellectual property rights are that are granted. The only reason this came up at all is that Aerojin, in the course of moving for summary judgment, made a full disclosure of all the deposits that had been made to its bank account. One of these was this $525,000 payment under the Cystic Fibrosis Agreement, which was not a grant of rights to practice the Benner patents. It had nothing to do with this case. We told that to the other side. They didn't take discovery. They didn't bring a 56F motion and say we'd like to look into that. Basically, after they brought their own motion for summary judgment, which didn't say anything about the Cystic Fibrosis Agreement,
seen it yet, right?
Well, they hadn't.
They asked for all of the agreements with Bayer.
They
hadn't seen it.
Again, now, I will concede that these were discovery disputes that never got resolved. But the fact is, they never asked for this until the end.
They don't say that.
I know they don't say that. But what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that to this day in this court. Benner, NAL, has never articulated why they think this agreement is covered under the Aegis Agreement. It isn't. They certainly didn't develop it for Judge Crabb. And I think what Judge Crabb said, she looked at it and she said, this doesn't have anything to do with this.
Well, we don't
again,
know what she thought.
Of
she
course we don't. What we do know is that she thought that all that we're entitled, that all that Benner was entitled to was $3,416, not $134. So she has rejected their claim.
We don't know if she didn't pay any attention to it. We have no idea. We're completely in the dark, which is why I'm concerned about
well,
the procedural posture.
Your Honor,
about
and
the
I,
way this came
I understand
out.
Your point. And the fact is, sometimes when you bring things up in reply on summary judgment for the first time, you put yourself in the posture where the district court doesn't talk about it.
That's correct. And then the question is, who is responsible for that? Is it the fault of the person who brings it up very late, or is it the fact that somebody else didn't make a disclosure when they were supposed to make it, thereby giving rise to the whole problem?
Well, I can't argue with that. All I can tell you is there was no motion under Rule 56F, which is exactly the procedure provided for this. There was no motion for reconsideration to Judge Crabb saying you've ignored cystic fibrosis and, you know, this wasn't produced in time or whatever their story was. So if I could speak to the just on the point that if we do come back before this court and this panel again later, you won't want to hear us again. If I could speak to the merits, the point I wanted to make about the interpretation of the 3.7 language, I think the court has in mind based on the questions asked to Ms. Kernut, and that is, this is just 3.7 is a one-off provision. It has to do when will we divide between the old rate and the new rate. And they've used the phrase with respect to revenues accruing under net sales, licensing agreements, and grants. And that's, I mean, you know, their explanation is their clarification of it from their lawyer that came in on reply in the trial court was, well, I was just clarifying what we meant by transactions. Well, the transactions in this case are sales of product. And that's what generates a royalty payment, is a sale of product.
How do we know that as opposed to a transaction being the turnover of money from licensee to licensor?
Well, because of the
too.
Because with respect to, for example, our own under 3.2, the payments that Aerogen makes for its own sales, it's with respect to sales. And with respect to sub-licensing payments, the contract provides that the amounts to be paid are based on, they're paid during a period in the ordinary course of the agreement based on the quarter in which they're paid.
Well, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
If you have a follow-up, go ahead.
My only follow-up is I can imagine why the parties might have chosen transaction to mean the licensee to licensor payment, because that's much easier for the licensor to monitor than wondering when all sorts of little sales had happened in the meantime or payments received. But, you know, it's just the district court thought this was an ambiguous term, and I'm not sure that she was wrong about that.
Well, all I can say is revenues accruing from net sales or sub-licensing on and after February 15th.
Right.
We had these transactions that are in dispute on the books before February 15th. They're carried on the general ledger of the company and trued up later on when the payments come in. So to me, that's how that is to be read. In some of the correspondence in October, the other side acknowledged that if, in fact, this was on the books, let us know, because that's essential to your argument, and we did. It's what I think it's the only interpretation consistent with the notion that revenues accrued clarifies transactions. I simply think that's what it means. Again, you know, we know Dr. Benner was on the board of the company. He certainly knows we use accrual accounting. When you've got such long delays in payments, because, of course, when Bayer, whatever sales it reports to us for a prior quarter don't come to us till 60 days later, if our books are going to be accurate, we've got to use accrual accounting in this business. Otherwise, you'd be 5 months off.
assuming that there was a breach of the agreement by Aerojin, as Judge Crabb determined, why didn't the contract terminate automatically?
I don't think
that if that breach was not corrected within 60 days. I'm having a hard time seeing this. Where you get the idea that NAL was obliged to send two notices to Aerojin, one of a breach and a second of the termination?
These arguments are made in response to this notion of an automatic termination, which wasn't raised before this court. I mean, until we got to this court, which is why we're responding to it. The argument is simply on 4.2 that the introductory clause to 4.2 is Benner may terminate this agreement upon written notice to Aerojin upon, and then it lists four things, three of which are simply, failure to pay taxes, failure to honor release, failure to honor an indemnification. The first one of which, though, is non-payment provided that Aerojin or its designee shall have the right to cure such breach within 60 days of Aerojin receiving written notice from Benner. And it seems to us that what that contemplates is a written notice of a breach, opportunity to cure, and then if the if Benner thinks that a cure has not occurred, then it takes written notice to Aerojin that 60 days has passed without curing. That's not our core argument, obviously.
If there was a breach, and it went uncorrected after 60 days, isn't it possible to construe what took place after 60 days as the parties operating without a written agreement? In other words, even if NAL had formally declared termination, 60 days, as you say, should have been done, there would have been some transition period, and during that time, wouldn't the parties have acted exactly as they did in November through March?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And probably the most important way that they wouldn't have is that Dr. Benner, NAL, should have given notice to the sub-licensees that I have replaced Aerojin as your licensor. I mean, what would be the point of leaving us in place? This notion of an automatic termination is just not consistent with the language of the contract. First of all, 4.2 says Benner may terminate upon.
But he did write the letter, and then they gave you the 60 days to cure.
He did, but
He didn't have to write a letter. He could have written you a letter saying, even though I'm not exercising the right to terminate, I wish you'd give me your report and let's sort this out amicably. He had the option. He could have done that, but he didn't. He wrote the termination letter.
But if, again, the assumption of Judge Robner's question was, but let's assume that the contract was breached, he didn't act like he was breaching. He had terminated the contract. Certainly sending us the power of attorney so that we could prosecute patent applications for him in November is wholly inconsistent with the notion that the contract terminated at the end of October. Certainly this whole dialogue, I can see what Judge Crabb's reaction to that February 21st letter from Benner's lawyer was. I mean, this is the agent of Benner acting on behalf of Benner, who says, basically, let's get this straightened out, make these payments, and we did.
If he hadn't done these things, you'd be arguing that he failed to mitigate his damages.
Well, I don't think that's the tone of the letter, though. I mean, what he says in there is wholly inconsistent with the contract.
But that is what you'd be arguing, because as Judge Robner says, he's operating in a certain amount of uncertainty. The parties could be finishing up those obligations that continue and even doing a few other things. Parties deal with each other all the time without written agreements, so I don't know why.
Well, but the parties weren't doing that. I mean, we were continuing to operate.
They weren't, but isn't that the issue? We don't want to assume the answer to the question before us.
Well, we were continuing to collect royalties or license fees. We were continuing to pay royalties. We were continuing to report.
And if there was no agreement, then under some quasi-contract theory, you had an obligation to turn that money over to the owner of the patents.
Well, maybe, Your Honor, but the February 21st letter is really quite inconsistent with the notion that what he's trying to do here is mitigate. He treats this, and again, even in letters in March and April, treats this as an ongoing relationship. If you don't do this, we may have to terminate you, is actually in the February 21 letter. That just simply is, he asks We claimed that we had overpaid by $49,000 and reported in September that there was another $7,000 difference that we had underdone, and we basically treated it as a $41,000 overpayment.
I remember that, but he knows that his position that you didn't pay enough in September is contested, right? You've sent him a bunch of letters saying not only did we pay you enough, we in fact overpaid you, was your position, because of the computational errors. So since he might have a terminated agreement if he prevails ultimately, but he might not, why isn't he just mitigating damages?
Well, he didn't say I'm mitigating damages.
No,
I'm acting to mitigate
not so
damages.
Words.
No, but he's the whole tone of the letter is that this is an ongoing relationship, that the contract is ongoing. The royalties that were due, the talk in here about the request that we just pay down the $7,000 rather than treating it as a reduction in what we've been overpaid, so that the only matter remaining will be the question of our interpretation of the contract. It seems to me, that everything about this, including the whole point about maintenance fees, which again we didn't have any obligation if this contract was terminated to take care of maintenance fees, and yet as late as March and April, they're saying, thank you for taking care. Will you take care of this maintenance fee? This is serious. Take care of it. We did. They said, thank you. I mean, this does not strike me, Your Honor, as, and I don't think it struck Judge Crabb, and I think she correctly read this, as action consistent with having terminated the relationship. You know, the waiver under Florida law, and I don't think is... Judge Easterbrook pointed out, I think Florida law is unique in this respect. Waiver, you don't have to. It isn't like somebody waiving his right to jury trial in a felony, where he has to come into court and say, yes, I waive my jury trial. You can waive it by conduct. And the conduct here is just inconsistent for a long period of time, particularly given that the letter on October 31st said, we assume this is all cleared up, let us know if we're wrong. You know, we then prosecute the patent for them at their request. They sent us materials to help us do that, which was not an obligation that survived termination. We go through this whole dialogue in February about can't you catch up the $7,000 so that the only dispute remaining is about whether or not accrual is proper. The whole point of the maintenance fees, will you take care of the maintenance fees? We took care of the maintenance fees. Some of those dated back from a time when Dr. Benner was administering this. I mean, some of those missed payments had occurred during his time. He was responsible for them. He always had the right, if he wanted to pay them himself and bill us. He never did. He asked us to do it. So I think that Judge Crabb quite clearly, she's very convincing, or whatever the phrase was that she used, evidence of waiver. This isn't like a situation. They mentioned the Jamestown telephone case, which I guess, where there had been a termination, Judge Lehman decision, there had been a termination not because of any default, but just a termination because the contract allowed it to be terminated on 90 days' notice. These cases from Florida, which govern, are all under situations where waiver can occur. And again, this contract says that. And they try to make the point that waivers have to be in writing. That isn't what 9.2 says. 9.2 says amendments and modifications and releases have to be in writing. 9.6 recognizes that either party can waive compliance with provisions of the contract. 9.6 says waiver by either party of a single breach shall not deprive such party of any right to terminate in the event of any subsequent breach. So the idea that there could be an automatic termination here, something that couldn't be waived by later conduct inconsistent with the contract continuing, I think is just not...
Is that unique to this contract, or you just don't think people can write contracts that
terminate
automatically?
There is, as a matter of fact, a case in which, one of the Florida cases,
right,
in which the contract said you have to have a waiver in writing. But that's not this case. So it is, I don't know that it's unique to this contract. I think this contract is probably a more common way of approaching it. But there isn't any prohibition against waiver in this contract. And,
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Schreiner. Anything further, Ms. Kernan? Brevity is guaranteed. You have less than a minute.
Arigen threatened litigation against Dr. Benner for years, and it's for that reason that he was very careful to comply with the terms of the agreement until he was able to confirm that termination had occurred. As Arigen did in this case, Arigen sued him for millions of dollars for an implied breach of covenant of good faith and fair dealing in this case, which is what Dr. Benner was afraid of and NAL was afraid of when they tried to continue complying with their responsibilities under the agreement. The arguments regarding the cystic fibrosis agreement's applicability under the Aegis agreement were set out in brief in the motion to strike Dr. Huzarski's third declaration and were before the district court. Finally, I'd just like to conclude by saying that our position is that the agreement did terminate automatically and that as a matter of law, NAL could not waive termination after that occurred. Dr. Benner did not know that he had a right that could be waived and simply could not waive after termination.
The case is taken under advisement.